Hello, and welcome to the Gentleman's Journal podcast, a new fortnightly discussion all about success, modern business, and the lives of entrepreneurs. I'm Joe Bullmore, I'll be your host for the day, and my guest this afternoon on this wonderful spring day in the circus room upstairs at Mark's Club is Theo Fennell, the jeweller and businessman. Theo's eponymous jewellery line is known for its wit, extravagance, and its achingly beautiful detail. Some of his most successful pieces include sterling silver Marmite lids, 18-carat gold nappy pins, and his signature skull rings, sporting by the likes of Elton John, Lady Gaga, and pretty much anyone who's anyone. Today he tells us why we should read more and want less, how it's okay not to have any idea at all what you want to do with your life, and why you should never trust an ugly man with a blonde girlfriend. So Theo, you were brought up in a kind of army family, and then you went to Eton. It's not the most traditional route into being a creative or making jewellery, perhaps, is it?
I don't think it was then, no. I mean, I remember an interview once saying that the interviewer said, was it common? And I said it was considered very common, but I think it was a different kind of life in those days.
Yeah.
And bizarrely, even though now you have so many actors and creatives coming out of private education, in those days, I think I was the only guy at that particular school who'd been to art school in 10 years.
Really?
Yeah, despite the fact there were wonderful drawing schools and art schools and things there, I think on the whole people didn't really take enough advantage of it.
So what was the kind of stock route? What were you expected to do, do you think?
I kind of always thought, I think in the way that people think that their parents have expectations, I think it was rather thought that I'd go into the army and then, you know, do whatever people do when they've been in the army after they've killed people, I guess, whatever it is. But I think it was my parents were perceptive enough, my father especially, to realize that I probably wouldn't be the world's greatest soldier at a fairly early age. So I guess the other route was going to be kind of university and what have you. I mean, literally, I had no idea what I was going to do at all, and I don't think they did. And in the end, when I said I'd love to go to art school, they were incredibly encouraging. So I did.
And was that part of the kind of the 60s and 70s? You mentioned you before we got on there that you grew up in Kensington. Is it that kind of West London art scene? Were you very much part of that?
No, not at all. No, my father being a soldier, I lived all over the world. So okay. I lived in Malaya and Egypt, Pakistan, a little bit in India, France, Germany. Literally the most peripatetic life. And came back to go to boarding school in England. You know, that kind of life that doesn't exist anymore, the sort of almost colonial kind of life. Very strange upbringing. And, you know, farmed out to a succession of great aunts and friends, I guess, and people that probably didn't want me there at all in some cases, you know, for sort of weekends and holidays and things, and the main holidays I go home. So it was a very kind of strange, in retrospect, at the time it seemed perfectly normal because there were so many people doing it, but it was a strange old life. And really, I guess the first thing that had any constancy to it was when my parents came back to England in the mid-60s, and I was at school in England in the mid-60s, and everything started to explode, all those ideas of what you could do for a living, which hadn't existed really before, and certainly hadn't existed in any kind of respectable way, suddenly kind of, you know, came onto the market. And so suddenly there were all sorts of things one could do that perhaps 10 years ago, 10 years before, rather, wouldn't have been in any way acceptable.
So what was the dream at art school? Did you want to be a fine artist, a sculptor, or was it always jewellery?
No, funnily enough, in those days you had to do a foundation course, and foundation courses are one of the great, great losses to the educational system. There are very few now, and they were wonderful things because a creative person could go there and try their hand at photography, letter writing, perspective, all sorts of different both vocational and non-vocational kind of art forms, as it were. And it was a fantastic thing. And at the end of it, they assume that you'd have your ideas pretty much under control, and then you'd go to the next place and specialise in that. And by the end of a fabulous year at York Art School, because it was our local one, as it happened at the time, and a very, very good one, very technical, I really had no particular idea, but what seemed like a good idea was to come to London and train to be a portrait painter, because I just sort of thought that would be a nice thing to do. It would be sort of, you know, I could maybe play golf in the morning and paint somebody in the afternoon and wander about. And I really didn't have much much real idea, to be honest. But I couldn't get a likeness, which is a huge drawback, obviously, if you're trying to be a portrait painter.
Did you get commissions early on that went drastically wrong?
Well, the very first commission I ever did, there were just, obviously, I was sitting painting this person who at lunch, I said, should we go and get some lunch? And they got up and looked at the picture and said, who's that? Which is always a little bit disconcerting.
And that was it, the last one you did?
Pretty much, yes. I mean, I draw a lot now. I sketch a lot, and I do a lot of things which are, you know, sort of passable. But to be honest, I didn't think it was really for me. So I left art school with a thing called a Dip AD, which in those days was somewhere between an O-level and a, you know, a sort of a nothing, really, in that nobody, unless you were doing something technically proficient, nobody really cared about it. And I kind of became that person they discuss at breakfast, you know, what are we going to do with Theo?
Right.
I would say, I'm actually here. You know, I am at the table.
Yeah.
Perhaps I could join this discussion, but nobody could really come up with anything in any way practical, to be honest. And a vocational guidance man had said, when it was very first sort of trendy to do so, we were all sent at school to, that I would probably suit being an architect, but it was a 7-year training and I probably didn't have the energy for that.
Okay.
Or I should be an end of peer performer.
Right. What, in Bryson Pier or something?
Or somewhere. He never actually said which pier. So obviously I was confused as to where to go next. Whitby, Brighton, wherever. Didn't seem particularly constructive. And in the nick of time, luckily my great aunt sent an advertisement for a silversmith in Hatton Garden who were looking for a sort of trainee, a man of artistic leanings, that kind of stuff, to go along and work with them. I had no idea what to expect and went along and they offered me a job. So, and I took it in the firm belief that nobody else was ever going to offer me a job. And that would be the start of something, which it turned out to be.
And did you know very quickly that this is something you'd like to be in for a long time, maybe your entire career?
Not to begin with at all. No, it was. I was first of all slightly kind of disconcerted by the fact that a job was a job and you had to be there on time and sort of do things on time and whatever. But I've actually, to be honest, always had a certain level of tenacity. So I think once I start something, I get quite bloody minded about it. And for the first bit, it was monumentally dull. You know, I was just writing repairs and things into this big ledger. A long time ago, it was very Dickensian, this place. So I was writing odd kind of remarks about repairs. And, you know, they had this language, which, you know, where a dent was a bruise and a make good and polish bruises and all that sort of stuff. And so it became a kind of strange, arcane language. And then after about a month of doing this, when I really thought seriously about ending it all, in every way it was so dull, they sent me down to the workshops, which I hadn't seen at that stage. So down this strange little corridor into this sort of Stygian gloom, and I opened this door, met by this unbelievable noise of crashing and banging, actually people laughing and shouting and whatever. And it was the silver workshops, which are not like a jewelry workshop in that they're much more active, much bigger, much noisier, much more like a sort of smith's, like a, you know, a blacksmith's. And there were all these different people and a very kind of eclectic bunch of people and ages making things, things that I'd never really thought, you know, about how they were made, you know, a candlestick or whatever. You sort of see one and you never really think, you know, how is that made? And just taking a lump of metal, crash, bang, polish, scrape, spin, and out came this brilliant thing at the other end. And it really struck a chord. It struck a really big chord there and then. Not completely sort of Damascene, but nearly enough to change my life at that stage.
So what was the moment that made you think that you could perhaps strike out on your own and make it as a business, as a businessman, an independent trader?
I don't think that moment has even come yet, to be honest. I think the answer is that if you are a creative, unless you're very unusual and your creativity is quite pragmatic and well-edited, on the whole, you're not a businessman. However canny you are, however bright you are, however numerate you may be, your mind is always on, it's not on the bottom line.
Okay.
You need somebody else to do that for you. I think there are some people like, I guess, Dyson, I guess, Paul Smith, those sort of people who have the combination. I don't know them or their businesses well enough to know how much is them and how much is others. But on the whole, I think it's you need a yin and yang, and not always easy to find. You know, that kind of yin and yang. And I think if you look at the world of creativity from, you know, at its most populistic, say, popular music, through to really kind of, say, intellectual writers, taking that sort of spectrum, you'd find that for them to go forward, they'll need someone else to do either some agency work for them, editing for them, pushing for them. And if it's going to be a commercial proposition, they need somebody who can edit them and their ideas into a way that becomes economically viable and what have you. So, and I think it's one of the things that doesn't get taught at art schools even now is how to be pragmatic, how to run a business.
So how did you find that yang to your creative yin?
I mean, it's taken a long time. I think, you know, if the truth be known, there were some yongs along the way, if there is such a thing, and some youngs or whatever, whatever the non-yang is to a ying. And, you know, it just takes a long time to recognize that sometimes. I mean, I think it's no one teaches you that. And I think, you know, if you are by nature, you know, your your mind is sort of fairly fluid, as it were, you tend not to concentrate on those things, and these things come and go and whatever. Yeah. And I think that and I think, again, it depends what is important in your life. I mean, I think, you know, the however trite it sounds, I've seen people who would be, in anyone's estimation, enormously successful financially, which is, unfortunately, nowadays the yardstick most often used, miserable, unfocused, families falling apart, whatever. And I think, you know, that there's a time has come and is coming that people are going to revise their thoughts on what is important and what isn't. Yeah. And I think we're having had this huge technological revolution, which is meant to have freed us up into being relaxed, laid back, and whatever. What it's actually done is seems to be the reverse. Suddenly there are 5,000 emails or 10,000 telephone calls, everything has to be answered, everything happens so quickly. It doesn't seem to be the time to soak things up, to read properly, to watch things properly. Films get shorter and more active, and you know, stimulus gets much greater, and choice is so enormous now that it's one of the great disasters of modern life is too much choice. And so I think I think going forward, people will be measuring people and their success in totally different criteria than they do now.
If you could see yourself in your sort of early 20s, would you be surprised to see that you've got a jewellery brand with your own name on it?
Yes, absolutely. Staggered. I think the answer is that in my case, and purely selfishly, I had a lot of interests and still have a lot of interests, a lot of things that I enjoy, a lot of things that appeal to me. I probably have a butterfly brain, I'm sure there'd be a technical description now,
right?
Of, you know, LBDNTA, okay, whatever it is. That
by that you mean a brain that flits around?
Yeah,
yeah.
And despite the fact that I can be very tenacious in one direction when I decide it, there's a lot of stuff going on at one time. So I mean, I'll enjoy, you know, music and reading and theatre and films and, you know, playing the guitar badly and, you know, writing songs badly and painting pretty badly and all those sort of things. But there is a joy to be had in doing a lot of things that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And I think there's this idea of specialization that, you know, all the other things are tawdry and unnecessary. Just do this or just do that. And I think it's made for a lot of tunnel vision. And I think, you know, the sort of education, I interview a lot of kids and work with a lot of kids, and, you know, both in college and in secondary education, whatever. And the two things that strike me most is how they are, on the whole, geared in one direction to do one thing.
Yeah.
So, but they don't kind of read very much, or, you know, the general breadth of education and reading and learning is pretty minimal. I mean, what would have been considered, you know, ill-read or ill-educated maybe 30 or 40 years ago, given if they've had the advantages they've had.
Mm.
And I think, as I say, the other thing is the level of their aspirations, that you know, this one direction is the only direction they want to reach the top. And, you know, there's not time to smell the roses, I don't think.
So they've read less and they want more, really.
I think that's a very good way of putting it.
And what?
I rather wish I said that myself.
what kind of answers then, if you are interviewing young people, what kind of things impress you? What makes you think this is someone worth hiring?
I think very old-fashioned values. I think loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
I think tenacity and common sense, personability, and, you know, a team player, in that terrible expression. But, you know, if they can do those things, they can be taught to do pretty much, you know, if you add talent to that, you add a spark to that, you've got somebody really, really important. But on the whole, you know, all those things that you would want to spend time on a desert island with, you know, if you suddenly find yourself washed up on a desert island and the next person who got out, male or female, was a pain in the ass and hugely ambitious and venal and self-centered, you wouldn't want to be with them, however bright, however brilliant, however driven they were. If they were personable and loyal and full of common sense and charm, you know, and that's who you want to share the world with.
And your kind of, your, I guess, to use a phrase that you probably won't like, your USP has been a kind of wit or slightly humorous, unusual takes on jewellery. How quickly did you hit on that? And is that kind of your personality coming through in your work, do you think?
Yeah, I don't think I hit on it. I think it was just inherent in what I did, because I'm a big fan of quirk.
Right.
And I think I always find things in both in three-dimensional objects and also in kind of more sort of nebulous things, either entertaining or interesting, things that I found had a story to them.
Yeah.
And therefore, when I sort of got interested in jewelry and silver, I found I went back to the days when people were making things that had some real heft to them. First of all, they were beautifully made and made with complexity and dexterity, which is so rare nowadays, because the default position of most jewelry and silverware is that it's made in vast quantities by huge brands, and that is their that's their business model.
Yeah,
they've got to make the same thing again and again and sell it again and again all over the world. And, you know, branding essentially is it gives you the license to make something as cheaply as possible that you can sell as expensively as possible in the greatest quantity. And that obviously takes the heart, it takes the soul, it takes the individuality out of things by its very nature. And, you know, the model for all those brands is that it has to be the same for it to work. You can't start doing one-offs, and you can't start doing bespoke work and things. And I've always liked the idea of bespoke work and having something made, you know, whether it's a pair of shoes or whether it's a garden or whatever it is, to your own taste and to your own delights and things. And I realized pretty early on that the people that would like it were people who shared many of the same interests that I did, and that people who didn't might find it a little bit hard to grasp or whatever. So I think what happened was, you know, what I am and what I was, what I loved, and the influences that I had, which were anything, as I say, from, you know, Gothic churches to rock and roll music, from, you know, Rococo sculpture to, I can't even think, but minimalist architecture, all those furniture, all those things sort of come into a little bits and pieces like a kaleidoscope, and what comes out then has its own life.
Do you often get young jewellery makers or young entrepreneurs coming to you and kind of pitching ideas or running ideas past you?
Yeah, all the time.
What's the idea that kind of that makes a light bulb go off in your head?
It's, you know, that's a really interesting question, because I've been thinking about that recently, because we do a prize for the Royal College, and we do the same at Central St Martin's, and we do some sort of mentoring and whatever. And I say we, because not as a royal we, but because I'm talking about the studio and the workshop. You know, it's very much a collective thing, and we sort of look after these kids. And going back to what I was talking about, the personability and all that sort of stuff, and decency and loyalty and whatever, goes with a real kind of enthusiasm to learn and to listen. I'm a very, very bad pupil. I mean, I really don't take advice at all well,
okay,
if at all. And it's something that still, you know, annoys me about myself, that if only I'd listened to, you know, people many more times, I would probably be, I'd probably be dead, actually. But if I would have... But I don't, but I know that these kids that do, and you can see them, and you see the spark, you can see them getting ideas and using things and being inquisitive and not being dogmatic about allowing new influences into their life, learning new things, and coming up with ideas that they can then work on and bring to fruition. It's a terrific thing when you see them, and it's not about this amazing ability to draw. It's not about an amazing ability to make something, although those are wonderful things. Those are kind of one-paced things. If they can combine that with a broad mind and the ability to take on board, you know, new ideas and to produce something out of those that's new and different, whatever, they've really got something. It's like seeing a sort of, you know, flower open.
Yeah.
And it's rare. Lots of talented kids, lots of kids who can make, who can draw, who can think things out, who have fantastically interesting ideas and things. But to assimilate all those into a kind of disciplined whole.
Yeah.
And be able to talk to the press, clients, whatever, tell people what they want in the way of crafts and whatever. To get those things together is not always apparent until they're a bit older, because they need the kind of experience of working in those ways, the practice to bring it to fruition.
And what kind of advice do you find yourself giving most often to these energetic and ambitious young entrepreneurs? Do you ever tell them not to get involved in the industry? Do you think it's changed?
Well, to be honest, what I'm dealing with is not so much entrepreneurs. I'm dealing with the raw material, which is the talent and the skill. And what I say to them is, do not do what I did.
Okay.
Learn about business. Learn about those things. You learn how to conduct yourself. Learn life skills. Learn how to do an interview.
Right.
Learn how to present to a bank or whatever it is. Learn these things, because they're the skills that are going to hold you in really good stead. We talked earlier about the desert, you know, the deserted island, as it were. when that person arrives who's personable and charming and laid back and somebody you want to chat to, if they can also build a house and know how to convert seawater into water and all those things, then they're twice the person. And I think those skills, those life skills, are incredibly important. And I would say to anybody, including myself as a, you know, as a sort of young idiot, learn those life skills, learn those more kind of elemental things, simply because even if you never use them, it gives you the confidence to know you're not being hoodwinked or having the wool pulled over your eyes.
We often hear this with entrepreneurs. You've got to really kind of live your idea and 7 days a week be kind of thinking about it, and it's got to be a real reflection of you. Do you think that's true, or do you think that's maybe overstating it a bit?
It sounds incredibly dull.
Right.
I mean, I think, you know, that the sort of person who is so obsessed with... Yeah. I mean, I think unless business is your hobby, I think, you know, I think for a lot of people who perhaps aren't creative, then it becomes a sort of their way through into creativity, I guess. Mm. You know, building a business or building an enterprise or building something like that becomes the very fabric of what they want to do. But I think the idea of being that obsessed with something that isn't genuinely creative would strike me as very dull, but certainly wouldn't strike other people. I mean, it's just horses for courses. I mean, you know, there are sports that bore some people to tears who are very fond of other sports, and there are, you know, art forms that bore somebody to tears, and, you know...
Yeah.
I think, you know, the diversity of life is just such an important thing. And I think the more you can pour into your own single life, the better.
Yeah. And I'm from hearing about the desert island, it sounds like you're very much a people person. Do you think it's more important who you know or what you know in this day and age?
Or what you know about who?
Yeah.
I think if you want to be really powerful.
Right.
No, I think, you know, everyone had a sort of an old aunt or somebody they looked up to.
Right.
And I had a great aunt, Dodie, who told me that great aphorism when I was very young, and everyone knows, which is people who matter don't mind and people who mind don't matter. And I think it's one of the really important things in life, that you be yourself and accepting of everybody as much as possible, and enjoy as much variety and as much as you can. So I would say, you know, it's who you know becomes what you know, because people influence you, people enthuse you. They're the catalysts that get you interested in things.
So I've heard you tell a great story about a man who came in once, I don't want to ruin the story, on a Friday afternoon, and you were kind of banking your entire weekend on this guy buying a big bracelet.
Well, actually it was an interesting episode, because it showed me how powerful jewelry can be.
Yeah.
And it was, almost kind of central casting sort of sent this man along who was squat and hideous.
Right.
And may well have worn some high street. Anyway, but he was that would be too good.
That would be.
This is a long time ago. This is 30 years ago. And it was Friday afternoon, and in Friday afternoons those days, we would sort of pack up as early as we could and go to the pub,
right.
You know, being driven young entrepreneurs. And it was about sort of 3-4 o'clock. No one's going to come in now, in this huge Rolls Royce parked up outside. And we were then on the corner of Fulham Road and Sydney Street. It was now Amanda Wakeley's shop. We had this little shop there. And, you know, it decanted this hideous little man. And then... after he'd got out, this sort of blonde uncoiled and came shimmering into the shop after him, giggling. They'd obviously had a very good lunch. And he said, "What do you like?" And she said, "Oh, can I?" Started trying on things. And we were going, "Well, you never know." And gradually, things she was trying on got more and more ambitious. And then in the end, she tried on the biggest pair of earrings we had. And he said, "Haven't you got anything bigger?" And by this time, she was, you know, genuinely frothing. And we suddenly realized we've got this necklace, which we never thought we'd sell, but because it was too expensive for our sort of clients in those days. It was £25,000, which, I mean, then was just you know, you could buy a flat. So we bought it up. She tried it on, went berserk, started kissing this wretched little man who said, you can have it. Have it. Anyway, she went berserk. We went berserk. He took his checkbook out, wrote out this check, and we went, I'm so sorry, it's Friday afternoon. We're not going to be able to get. He said, don't worry, I'll come pick it up, you know, cash the check, whatever. And off they went, giggling into the night in the Rolls Royce whoosh. Inside the shop, mayhem. £25,000 was like, you know, 6 months turnover, whatever it was for us then. And put the check in the box with the necklace, and off we went over the road to the pub, where we got absolutely merry. Anyway, Monday morning, it was a great weekend. Monday morning, I get to work. Suddenly the Rolls Royce pulls up outside. I think, oh, God, here he comes again. Out gets a little bloke, no blonde, comes in and says, you know, have you still got the necklace? And I said, well, of course we have. Have you still got the check? I said, yeah. So I took the box out, the check, took the check out and ripped it up. And I said, do you want to give me cash? He said, no, mate, you keep the necklace, but thanks for a great weekend.
Oh, my word. So was that that's a pretty harsh lesson in the realities of life.
Well, it's either a harsh lesson or a great lesson, depending on which side of the fence you are. But I realized, funny enough, not only was it a terrific wheeze, not only he had a great weekend, I'd had a great weekend because, you know, just the hope of the fact that we'd sold it was enough for me, as it was indeed for her.
And so that put a good fire in your belly to sell.
Well, he made two people happy for a weekend anyway. But it also taught me that if you are slightly sociopathic, you can do that kind of thing. And I realized that I simply couldn't do that kind of thing. I wouldn't be able. I'm incapable of doing a thing like that without suddenly bursting into tears and telling her that I was a complete fake and I didn't have any money and I'm so sorry. Not because I'm a good person, but because I'm a coward.
Okay. And do you have a personal motto aside from don't trust stubby men with blonde girlfriends?
Oh my God, almighty, the world, I wouldn't be able to move if I really thought that was my motto. I mean, the you'd only be able to go to Pinner. No, I mean, I think my Semper Fidelis is my mother's family's motto. And my father's family's motto, if it had one, I think would be something like whatever. But I think that I think constancy is a really terrific, terrific thing. And I think what I said earlier, I think people who mind don't matter and people who matter don't mind is just a terrific way to live your life. I think live and let live.
Brilliant. Theo, thank you very much for speaking to us.
My pleasure.
Thank you very, very much for listening to this episode of the Gentleman's Journal podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with more invaluable insights from the world of entrepreneurs. But until then, you can find us on our website, which is www.thegentlemansjournal.com. Or if you're so inclined, follow us on Instagram at The Gents Journal or indeed on Twitter at The Gents Journal. Thanks again for listening and we'll see you very, very soon.